Hello and welcome to Mega City Book Club, the podcast all about the galaxy's greatest comics. I'm Eamon Clark and I'm welcoming back from episode 163, Faceache, a warm welcome return to Robert Hager. Good morning, Robert.
Morning, Eamon. It's great to be with you.
Oh, it's great to have you back. Now, obviously, we did Ken Reed last time. We did Faceache and we were talking about a British comics genius and his madcap creations. We're in similar territory today because we're sticking with what we could call comics, aren't we? Tell us what we're doing today, Robert.
Well, we're going to look at, primarily we're looking at Dudley D. Watkins, really, who's, again, that comic genius along the same lines of Ken Reed, if you like, in terms of stature. And I suppose we're using Lord Snooty from the Beano as a starting point, really, to discuss Watkins' work in its various forms.
So we have both got an enormous coffee table-sized hardback of The Legend of Lord Snooty and His Pals by Dudley D. Watkins, 60 years of classic cartoon art, collecting stories that ran in the Beano from 1938 to 1968. Strangely enough, first of all, to say the sticker price on the inside of mine says £5.75. You can get it an awful lot cheaper than that now.
Yes.
this is one from the second hands. Doesn't seem to have a publishing indicia on it at all. So I presume it's a DC Thompson
it book. It is. It's actually, it's on page 92.
Ah, right.
He's published it. I know it usually comes at the front, but for some reason they've put it on page 92 here. That it's published and printed by DC Thompson, 1998.
There it is. Yes, buried away at the back of the book. Okay, cool. Mostly it's in black and white.
Yes.
There are some colour pages which give a little bit of history of Lord Snooty. I'm guessing, did Lord Snooty get the front cover of the Beano at all?
I don't think he ever did, no. So the first issue of the Beano, which Lord Snooty was in, famously, I guess, this is one of the reasons why he has perhaps sustained or he's remembered, is because he was one of the initial characters in the Beano and maybe one of the most popular to begin with. But it was Big Ego was on the cover of the first issue of the Beano. And I think Dudley D. Watkins might have drawn that one as well. But Snooty was a regular, certainly from the first issue. Yeah, first issue onwards.
Now, I remember from when you were last on the book club, you talked about the sort of graduation from what David Roach described as nursery comics into sort of comedy comics. What were your first experiences with the Beano and coming across Lord Snooty?
Well, that's a great question because actually, I definitely read the Beano in the mid 1970s. Whenever I was quite young, and certainly at the time that the characters that jumped out at me were Dennis the Menace, Bash Street Kids, the very well known strips. Roger the Dodger, always loved Roger the Dodger. Those sorts of comics. Very interestingly, I do remember Lord Snooty because one of the reasons why I guess he was continuing to be published was that he had been there from the beginning, although as this book reveals, there was a period where he took a break. I think it was about 6 months or maybe a year in the late 40s, early 50s, when actually he wasn't in the Beano, so I hadn't realised that. But he was a character who had been in number one and was still going. In fact, I can remember reading are getting number 2000 of the Beano, which came out in 1980. And that was when it revealed that Lord Snooty was in the first issue. And I remember feeling shocked because I was thinking, that story, that's the one that was in the first issue because I really didn't like Lord Snooty. The story as it was in the 1970s, I found quite banal in comparison with quite a few of the other strips in the comic. And apologies if any of the creators are listening from the 1970s, but it wasn't particularly good. And I just read recently that the strip continued until 1991, and at that time the editor Ewan Kerr he got rid of it and Kerr was on record as saying he never liked Snooty. he was very keen. He thought it was anachronistic by that time to have Lord Snooty in the comic, and I think he was probably absolutely right to make that conclusion. But what we'll come on to, I guess, is the Snooty that we see in the very early days is very different even from the Snooty I was reading in the 1970s. And I must say, I didn't actually buy this book. This was bought for me because actually my own memories of Snooty were as such that I wasn't that keen on him. And I wouldn't have necessarily have picked this book up, but I think my wife bought it for me, actually. And then reading the early stories, I went, oh, okay, now I can see why he was popular. I can see why there's something in this, actually.
So let's go back, as you say, all the way to the first issue of the Beano in 1938, Lord Snooty and his pals. Who is Lord Snooty, at least at the start of the strip, and his pals? And what are the sort of adventures that they have? What's the sort of concept of these one-page comics?
Yeah, well, that's a good question because actually it does change over that period of time. So the Lord Snooty we get in the first issue, even actually 6 months later, he's quite different. So Lord Snooty, his real name is Lord Marmaduke, and he's the Earl of Bunkerton, I think is the name of the place where he is. Now, his attire is very, it's Etonian. You know, it's very clearly Etonian. So he's got the black kind of blazer. He's got the top hat. He has the bow tie. So he does look like someone out of time. And it's very interesting to see this character being portrayed in the Beano at this time. And I suppose that this I should just a little bit more context is the Beano is published, or the first issue of the Beano is published about a year after, or maybe a little bit less than that, the first issue of The Dandy. So DC Thompson have launched these two comics. The Dandy's been incredibly popular, so they've launched the Beano off the back of it. And one of the things that DC Thompson, who often are perceived as being very conservative, they were very much of a mindset that they wanted to produce characters who were kind of a little bit rebellious, if you like, and sort of anti-authoritarian figures. So it was quite interesting to see that you've got this character who is very authoritarian, who's very much representing the upper classes, if you like. So what the R.D., I think it was R.D. Lowe, oh no, sorry, I'm thinking of R. Woolley there, whoever wrote the first issue of Lord Snooty had a very clever idea to make sure that Snooty wasn't part of the was sort of part of the establishment, but also resented being part of the establishment. So you can see Snooty in his castle, and he's got his butlers, he's got his aunt. I can't remember the aunt, was it Matilda? Who becomes a regular character. But what happens very quickly in the comic is that he it's almost like the poor little rich boy, and I saw writing on it that they were comparing him with the prince and the pauper in some respects. So he dresses down, he goes to meet his friends in the town, the Ashcan gang, and he sort of, that's kind of when he feels like he's himself, once he's actually with this sort of down and dirty gang, if you like, who are in the town, these other kids, and he feels at home with them. And the first strip actually ends in a very interesting way, because he has these posh friends who are coming to see him, but he and the Ashcan gang actually assault them, if you like, on the way to the castle. And then when they turn up to the castle with a birthday present for Snooty, Snooty says, well, that's a pile of rubbish because actually it's all wrecked. And the reason it's wrecked is because he's just wrecked it with his gang. So it's quite it's an odd beginning in some respects, but it's very much trying to indicate to the readers, I think, yes, okay, we've got this establishment character, but actually he's one of us. We're going to bring him into a gang where he is almost at an equal level.
And just mention, because we're going to get back to class distinctions in comics, but you've got this very clear class distinction with, as you say, the young Etonian Lord Snooty, and then these rough and ready Beezer kids of Ashcan Alley, the Ashcan gang, as you said, memorable characters that he much prefers playing with than with his sort of posh friends and family.
Very much so. And it's interesting because, there, as you mentioned, there's a sort of, it's set up in such a way that there are these supporting characters. And it's interesting to note that they don't sustain all the way through the run of Lord Snooty up till 1991. So Scrapper Smith, actually, I think, is one of the few that sustains that run. He changes over in the early 50s to... and I think I find it a slightly peculiar decision in some respects, because whenever this gang is introduced, you really, as you've kind of given an allusion to, you get a sense of the griminess of these characters very much. You know, this is the working class poor of the neighbourhood, perhaps, that he's aligning himself with. It reminds me a little bit, actually, of Angels with Dirty Faces. I don't know if you've ever seen that film.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Cagney film.
Yeah, very much, yeah.
There's this sort of gang. It's all about the gang. It's not so much about Cagney's character in some respects, that film. It's about the gang that he's influencing. This particular gang kind of reminds me a little bit of that. You know, so there's very much that sense that you've got the contrast between Snooty, the very posh kid, and then this other gang he hangs out with.
And just for our American listeners, we can say that he predates the American comic book character Richie Rich, I believe. Richie Rich had that same thing, the rich boy who liked to play with his less fortunate friends. Richie Rich, I think 1953 I put in our notes, so actually predates it by some years. But interesting, you get this sort of cross-Atlantic similarities in some of these comics.
Yes, yes, I'm not terribly familiar with Richie Rich at all. I know the character you're talking about, but I wouldn't know enough to compare him with Snooty at all.
We'll mention, because obviously we're going to get into the subject of how childhood and class is again depicted in these comedy comics. He has the advantage, Lord Snooty, of course, that he can always treat his gang friends to the slap at meal. Last time we did talk about depictions of food in British comics, and we do get some of it again, don't we?
Yeah, very, very much so. To the extent that he's trying to, I mean, one of the things that the Ashcan gang benefit from is the fact that he wants them to come to his castle. He wants to feed them. He wants to give them the big meal. And yes, some of the final frames, which is a recurrent trope within these comics, is that everyone gathered round a big table with a mountain of food in front of them, very much reflecting the times. It wouldn't make much sense now to end a comic with that, because why would you end your comic with, oh, we're getting dinner together? There's nothing special about that.
No.
But back then it would have been seen as something quite, a bit more special in that way.
And before I ask you about like the big event that turned up a few years after literally the year after the Beano was launched, but I'll mention that also there's other recurring characters in Lord Snooty. There's his aunt, you've mentioned, the butler. Later on, I think there's Professor Screwtop, the madcap inventor, turns up for a while, isn't he?
That's right, yes. And these are quite important characters. It's Mildred, I think, rather than Matilda. I can't remember. But anyway, the aunt, yes, she certainly sustains in the run. I don't think the professor does so much, or maybe he sort of occurs occasionally. We have Snitchy and Snatchy, who aren't there initially, but they're sort of, if you've ever seen Lord Snooty, you notice those characters immediately. They're almost like toddler kind of age characters. There's another one called Rosie as well who sustains. And then after 1950, he brings in a whole new... it's interesting that what happens in... I know I'm jumping ahead and we'll go back, but in 1950, he brings in a character called Fat Joe. Again, that's interesting of the times, because you wouldn't have a character called Fat Joe now.
No.
That would not be deemed appropriate. And also... is it Lanky Lizzie, something like that? So he brings in these other characters from other stories. And in a way, that kind of dilutes the contrast, I think, in some respects, to what we're seeing initially in these first few years, where he is this, where he has, as I say, this kind of grimy gang that he's hanging out with. And I think that takes quite a lot of the edge off the strip, actually, once these other characters come in.
Okay. Well, let's also talk about something that also put an edge into the strip, which is, of course, World War II happens very soon after Lord Snooty begins. And, you know, I don't know how typical this was, but the strip makes... it doesn't ignore the war. The war becomes part of the strip, doesn't it?
Very much so. And just before we go on to talk about the war itself, one of the things that it's probably worth pointing out is that it's clear in that first year, these creators are trying to find their feet with what they want to do with Snooty. So whilst in those first run of issues, you see him dressing like the Ashkang gang, they drop that very, very quickly, and they actually move to they actually lean into a little bit more on the fact that actually Lord Snooty is privileged, and actually one of the benefits of that is that actually he has access to things that the other members of the gang don't. But when the war comes along, they don't ignore it at all, and especially in the first couple of years, which is really, really interesting. And to my mind, you get some of the very best strips in the Lord Snooty run in 1940, 1941, in particular, where Snooty enters into something of a dialogue with Adolf Hitler. And this is where, for me, you see some of the greatness of the writing in these first few years, because they lean heavily into being very surreal. In a way which is lost in Lord Snooty much later on. And you see weird interactions like Hitler sending the Luftwaffe over the Bunkerton Castle to drop letters directly to Lord Snooty to say, Snooty, my castle's as good as yours, and now I'm going to come over and take over your one so I can have them both. You know, so you have these weird little bits of dialogue between Snooty and Hitler, for example. And there are some very surreal scenes that emerge as a result of this. One particular memorable one for me is... actually, it's that same story, funnily enough, is where the professor that you just alluded to creates a medicine which it's very hard to describe, but it ends up with the kids having these very strange elongated arms.
Yes.
This is the August the 10th, 1940 strip. And they have their arms become so large is that they're able to pick up the bombs that would normally drop out of planes that are sitting around as they are in 1940, perhaps. These bombs are just sitting around. And they're able to pick up these bombs and they're able to hurl them from England into Germany just by hand. So in effect, they end up blowing up Hitler's castle rather than Hitler coming and taking over Snooty's castle. So it's this kind of surreal scenarios that the writers are very eager and to lean into in these first few years, and I think very effectively, actually.
I'll mention in that particular strip, which I'd also stood out to me, is that the other thing you often find in these comics is there's always a visiting circus nearby, and in this case, some seals have escaped from the circus, and they've trained them to catch the bombs. Which, as you say, and then they used a professor's weird growth medicine to make their arms enlarge so they can hurl the bombs back. Yeah, it's bizarre and surreal. And they repel invasion as well, don't they, I believe? You know, obviously that great fear during World War II of an invasion of Britain. And Snooty, Lord Snooty and his pals, a bit like Dad's Army in a way, they deal with the invasion themselves.
Yeah, very, very much so. You know, there's a wide range of weird and wonderful stories. There's a story opposite this one on the same page where they actually have, again, using the professor's weird medicines and potions, they grew moths to supersize, and the moths then, the Germans are parachuting into England, and the moths fly up and they start pecking at this parachute so that you know that they all drop to the ground. Then, so just weird stuff that's going on all the time. There's a very interesting story which isn't in this collection, but it's in the Dan Di Bino 50 Golden Years collection, which I'll just allude to, where you actually see the Germans themselves getting a hard time from Hitler, and the Germans are a bit grumpy and they're not very happy, the German soldiers, as you'd say. And at one point, one of the German soldiers says, "If only we had the Bino comic like the British kids, we would be as happy as larks." You know, so there's kind of a weird thing. And that then ends up with the Luftwaffe coming over and nicking all the Binos so then that the Germans can have it. And at one point, the kids are sort of knocking about, and you can see in the background, there's ha, ha, ha is rising into the sky. And they're saying, oh, we can hear them laughing in Germany. You know, nice. There's just a lot of kind of real surreal sort of stuff going on. One of the interesting things that we might forget about this reading it in 2025, I do apologize, is that we could forget that this is being written contemporaneously. And obviously there is no sense for the readers or the writers as to what the outcome of the war is going to be. So there's kind of a bravery about this. There's obviously a great intent to mock Hitler and a great intent to put him down and to really get, I suppose, British kids behind the idea of getting behind the war effort. There's also allusions at times as well to the fact that there's a paper shortage. In one strip, they begin the strip by going into the newsagents and picking up their copies of the Bino, and the newsagent saying to them in return, "Yes, you put them on order, so that means we were able to get them in for you," which was maybe a tacit message from the editors to say, "Look, if you don't order your comic, you may not get it because we can only release an X number of comics." And the Bino was, during the war years, was published on alternate weeks with the Dandy. So they both came out fortnightly. It was the Dandy one week, then the Bino the next, again, because of the things like paper shortage. So there was that real sense of, especially in these ones from 1940, when the battle, when the Blitz was probably going on and different things like that. So there's a real sense of fear and danger, perhaps, there. And the Bino being brave enough to sort of poke fun at all that.
I'm looking at July 17th, 1943, and again, we have a concern about how to feed the troops, and using one of the professor's inventions, Lord Snooty is helping feed the armed forces. And again, you get these lavish depictions, giant turkeys and puddings dripping in custard or cream and great big pies as ever, you know. Again, that sort of, because obviously not only was there paper rationing, but other, you know, food rationing would be coming in. And we talked last time about post-war austerity. This is the sort of start of it in a way, isn't it? You know, concerns about food and its supply.
Yeah, and I think that's really interesting, actually, is that sort of sense of maybe those who are privileged doing their bit and supplying for others. There is a sense, another thing that actually happens to Lord Snooty's castle at one point is that it doesn't get bombed. Maybe that would have been too traumatic for the readership, but a bomb's dropped near the castle that it blows out all the windows. And again, I can imagine that many readers would have certainly maybe have experiences of that, or family members who would have had experiences of their homes either being destroyed or their windows being blown in. So when they see that actually this happens to Snooty as well, there's maybe a bit of empathy kind of being tried displayed there. But also there's even in the pre-war comics, as I mentioned earlier, there's that sense that they lean into Snooty's privilege, which I think is kind of the right thing to do, because you want to have that contrast between who Lord Snooty is, because otherwise he's just a Bash Street kid, if you like, if he's just a member of the Ashkang Alley gang. And whenever there's one point where the police arrest a bunch of vagrants, I guess, who actually turn out to be jugglers, and Snooty wants them released from jail. So he just goes into the police station and saying, my good man, would you mind releasing these prisoners? And they say, oh, yes, of course, Lord Marmaduke, we would certainly do that for you. And so there's that sort of sense that it does reveal at times that he does have this kind of privilege in these early strips. That's used quite usefully. For example, the fact that he can go to the professor and say, Professor, can you make me life-size mechanical animals? Oh, by the way, I need them by 8 o'clock this evening. And of course, the professor then will go and do that for him.
Yeah, remarkable stuff. And always, as I say, these are one-page comics, and always with a great gag for the end and madcap stuff. We're going to talk a little bit more about the cultural significance of Lord Snooty, about class depictions and so on. But let's take a diversion into his creator, into Dudley D. Watkins. What can you tell us about yet another remarkable genius of British cartooning?
Yeah, so, I mean, Watkins, interesting that he was a lifetime worker, really, with DC Thompson. I think he turned up there in 1925 with a six-month contract, and he was there until he died. So, you know, he sustained a good length of time there. What I hadn't realized initially was that, because obviously he's writing for DC Thompson, I thought maybe that he was Scottish, but he's not Scottish, he's English. He was born in Manchester. He grew up in Nottingham, and actually went to, I think, a college of art in Nottingham. And actually, I think that's quite interesting because when I looked at David Roach's book a few years ago, and I was thinking about Dudley D. Watkins and his work, and I was thinking it's extraordinary, it's very original, it's really, you know, there's so much going on in each panel. As you've just mentioned, there's maybe 20 panels to a page, and they're crammed full of detail. There's loads going on. But when I read Roach's book, I was struck by the fact that there were people prior to Watkins who were drawing in similar way. And one who struck me was a guy called Tom Brown. If you go back to that particular book, Brown was drawing in the late 19th century, early 20th century. And you can actually see similarities in his work. An interesting thing about Tom Brown was that he was from Nottingham. So I wonder, now Brown died in 1910. He died at a very early age. But by the time that Watkins turns up at the Nottingham College of Art, you can't help but think that perhaps there's some of Brown's work is being referred to or on display or whatever, because actually there's quite a lot of similarities, I think, between Brown's work and between Watkins, the way that his cartooning has developed as well. So you can kind of see that development. But anyway, he ends up in Dundee in the mid-1920s, and he begins work for them illustrating stories in some of the boys' comics at the time. So The Rover, The Wizard, I think, a comic called Adventure, which I'll allude to later as well. So this is his origin story, if you like, prior to what he becomes much more famous for doing. He was drawing illustrations for more serious comics, which he kept doing to an extent through his life, which again we can talk about. But certainly, it's maybe surprising to know that initially he was doing the, the more perhaps that slightly older age group, and the more the 2000 AD of its time in some ways. Perhaps The Rover and Wizard, you know, they were not quite the same kind of comic, but certainly that's the sort of aimed at that kind of readership, I guess.
And he ends up in the unofficial creative heartbeat of British comics, Brotty Ferry, where he and his wife built their house, and sadly died of a heart attack at his drawing board in 1969.
That's right.
Had done Lord Snooty right from 1938, right up and, you know, working on him right up until his death. He also created, I mean, he's... you know, Dudley Watkins created many other memorable characters for DC Thompson, some of whom may come up on the book club in the future. Tell us about some of those.
Yeah, well, I mean, we're going to come on to someone very famous, or a couple of very famous creations in a moment. But before we do that, I'm just going to show you, this is from, there's a book that I showed Eamon earlier, the Beano and Dandy, A Celebration of Dudley D. Watkins. It came out in 2020. You might still be able to pick up a copy on eBay or whatever if you're interested. It's very, very good, actually. And I'm showing Eamon something called Percy Vere,
right,
and his Prying Tricks. And this is one of the first regular strips that Watkins did, which would have been in Adventure in the mid-1930s. And you can actually see from the style that it's not quite typical what you might expect from Dudley D. Watkins. He's maybe still finding his way with this sort of more humorous comic, as you were mentioning earlier. But you can sort of see that he's beginning to find his way. Then a year later, in 1936, the most famous moment in Dudley D. Watkins' life, if you like, or the most seminal moment, perhaps, where he is asked to illustrate two new cartoons that the Sunday Post, a Scottish paper, are going to publish, and that's R. Wally and the Bruins. Very, very famous cartoon strips, which still are being published today. So just to put that in context, these predate the Dandy and the Beano. These predate these very famous characters like Dennis the Menace by many years. And as I say, come out every week in the Sunday Post till today. And I'm showing Eamon the very first R. Wally that was published in the Sunday Post in March 1936. And what's interesting, R. Wally has got a very distinctive look with dungarees and spiky hair. And he's got his dungarees on here. But it's really interesting, his hair isn't spiky.
Right.
Yeah. They haven't quite nailed the hair
haven't
yet.
Haven't quite got him yet, yeah.
They haven't developed it. The other thing to note with the very early strips of R. Wally is that they're in this particular... Again, Watkins seems to be still finding his way in terms of how to illustrate the character. It's a little bit more rough and ready, and we can see that actually even in the early Lord Snooty strips. Some of the artwork is slightly more rough and ready than what we see later. Some of R. Wally the Bruins and Lord Snooty and some of his other creations, they become cleaner over time in the way that they're illustrated. Although that doesn't really hurt the characters at all, but it's just interesting to see that development. That you know, it's a work in progress, if you like, in those early days.
And of course, he also goes on to create Desperate Dan for the Dandy.
That's correct. Yes, and Desperate Dan is one of the very much one of the great characters. In fact, the year before the Lord Snooty book that we have came out, D.C. Thompson published The Legend of Desperate Dan, so very similar sort of collection. I have to say, D.C. Thompson have always treated Watkins' work very well. They you know, there's that sense of reverence, really, that has been given to it. Every year they will publish books on the Bruins and R. Wally, and typically it's Watkins strips that they're reproducing. It's not the strips that came after necessarily, although the smaller annuals that you sometimes get. I'm just showing Eamon this year's R. Wally annual. This is actually the most recent artist, who's Mike Donaldson, is illustrating this one, for example. But the more kind of hardback bound collections tend to be on Watkins' work. And in fact, it was one the first time I really came across, without realizing it, if you like, I got this book called The Desperate Dan Book, 1979, and it was a collection of Watkins strips of Desperate Dan in this particular book from over the years. And again, even at the time, whenever I was reading this, I was thinking these stories are really interesting, really inventive in a way that some of the ones that were being published in the comic didn't seem to. They seemed to be more elaborate and more extraordinary than perhaps what was then happening. And I think it's interesting tracing the way the stories progress, even in our Legend of Lord Snooty book, because you can see over the period of time is that things seem to get more conservative. The surreal stuff goes completely, or almost completely, really, as time goes on.
So, obviously, a very famous artist for DC Thompson. R. Willie and the Bruins. I'm still waiting for somebody to pick one or other or both of those for the podcast so that I can get into them more, because obviously they are certainly a Scottish national institution now.
Absolutely.
Yeah, still, as you say, putting out an annual every year. Dudley Watkins was one of the two DC Thompson artists who could get away with signing his artwork, and he even appears in Lord Snooty himself in a bit of meta storytelling.
Yeah, again, you know, this was in the era when it was allowed to be a little bit surreal. and I'll maybe come back to that one, if you don't mind, a bit later on, Eamon, because I think it's worth definitely touching on. But just in terms of the Bruins, as you just mentioned, being a Scottish institution, one of the things that I did prior to us talking today was that I was aware there was a documentary that BBC Scotland had done a few years ago. Actually, it was 20 years ago. I didn't realize it was so long ago. I think for the 70th anniversary of R. Woolley and the Bruins. Really interesting little documentary. It's on YouTube if anyone wants to watch that. And one of the reasons why it might be appealing to the people listening to the podcast is that they have lots of talking heads. They're all Scottish. So you have Ricky Ross from Deacon Blue, for example, who talks, Muriel Gray, a number of actors who talks. But very interestingly, sitting side by side on a sofa, you have Frank Quitely and Grant Morrison.
Oh, right, yes.
Having the reminiscence of the Bruins. And you can see that actually the Bruins were very influential. Every Scottish family knew who they were. They sort of reflected, in some respects, reflected a stereotype of working class Glaswegian life, I guess, in some respect. But certainly you see Grant Morrison reminiscing about a particular story which he found very amusing. So it's great to know that actually Morrison and his work is indirectly influenced by the Bruins, indirectly influenced by Watkins. So it's worth checking that out if you're interested in the Bruins and R. Woolley.
Great stuff. So let's go back to the strip itself and Lord Snooty, because we had some interesting stuff last time talking about post-war austerity and depictions of children in British comics. And here we've got similar themes, but we've also now got this class element or this prosperity element that, you know, in a way, Lord Snooty is an aspirational figure for the readers and the Ashcan kids. What do you make about the way it depicts, I suppose, ordinary British life and this depiction of class in the comic?
Well, I think it's interesting, as I mentioned earlier, that the fact that what they realize intelligently, in my opinion, is that if it was just about Lord Snooty and his castle and how much money he had, you know, that probably wasn't going to go down terribly well with a lot of the readers. And I don't know if that's a difference maybe with Richie Rich, you know, who you mentioned earlier, whereas American readers might be more interested in that more aspirational kind of angle that they would look up to, or they would aspire perhaps to an individual like that. What's important with Lord Snooty is that he is willing to come down from his lofty heights, if you like.
He's downwardly mobile.
In a way, yeah, absolutely. But at the same time, having access, he uses his privilege well, if you like, to creatively in the comics, and also to help his pals and to help with the war effort, as you just mentioned earlier. So there's always that sense there is the class difference is there. But I do think, interestingly, I do think it becomes much more diluted especially after the war in this case, where it's almost phased out that Snooty's almost like he's not that different from the other kids. You have things like Snooty gets the bus on occasion, whereas in the initial strips he has like a horse-drawn carriage and things like that there, you know. So they're kind of a downplay it in some respects, and I don't know that that's terribly effective. I do find towards the end of this book, the book is very interesting, and I highly recommend, especially maybe the first 20, 30 stories. But after that, it becomes a bit more anodyne, I think. And by the end, I can see the type of strip that I was reading in the 1970s and not particularly enjoying. There's one episode towards the end in the 1960s where you have Snooty and the gang. They seem to be, it's almost like they're in the jungle. They're going through all this grassland that's way above their heads. And it's a one-note joke. Basically, at the end, they come out of the grass and you realize they haven't mown the lawn in ages, and so the grass has grown really, really high. And it's a kind of a bit of a boring joke, really. It's a bit of a banal joke. And it seems really a million miles away to what they were doing previously in those early strips, which are incredibly funny and very inventive, very surreal. And it seems to have lost its way a little bit by that stage, I'm afraid to say. I should also just mention, we did talk about the fact that Watkins was drawing Snooty in 1938, and he was drawing Snooty in the late 60s as well, but he did take a break from Snooty. And maybe this is another thing that we could touch on, Eamon, is the fact that that Watkins was incredibly prolific.
Mm.
So if you took an average week in the 1950s, and let's say it was at a time when Watkins is still drawing Snooty, so he's drawing Lord Snooty, he's drawing Desperate Dan for the Dandy, he's drawing Biffo the Bear for the Beano, he's drawing a character called Mickey the Monkey for the Topper, he's drawing a character called Ginger, who's basically an English R. Wooly, for the Beezer. He's drawing R. Wooly, he's drawing the Bruins, and he's drawing these characters for 50 to 52 weeks of a year. He's incredibly prolific. I looked at some documentaries prior to coming on here, and individuals talk about him. Well, they say there's three aspects to him, if you like. Number one, he's very quiet. He doesn't say much. He doesn't come, you know, he's not very sociable, perhaps, you know. Number two, he's incredibly hardworking. And obviously we can see that he's apparently was quite a quick draftsman as well. And number three was that he maybe came from, or there's a suggestion that he was involved in like a more fundamentalist Christian sect, which I'm not sure I totally buy how strict that might have been, because if I grew up in Belfast, so I kind of know a bit about fundamentalism. And if Watkins was very fundamentalist, he would not have been publishing cartoon strips that was being published in a newspaper that was coming out on a Sunday, you know. So I would take that with a little bit of a pinch of salt. That said, another memory that I have from my own childhood is that I got for a Christmas present a book called William the Warrior, which you may not be familiar with, but it was done for an evangelical Christian organization. And it was about this young kid who was a young Christian. It was published in an evangelical magazine called The Young Warrior, which has nothing to do with the 1980s comic Warrior, I should say. But it was collected into a little book, and I was having a look for it on the internet earlier, and it's quite rare to I wish I'd kept it now because it's quite rare. It's a little collection of these stories of this young lad who, becomes a Christian, and then, you know, what happens then. So that was kind of reflecting, I guess, Watkins' own personal Christian beliefs.
I'll mention, of course, that Lord Snooty crosses over into the cultural zeitgeist.
Yes.
In that the name has become an expression, a bit of slang, and interestingly, a bit of slang that doesn't necessarily actually depict what the character was in the comics, in a way.
I think you're absolutely right. So, I mean, in recent years, the Jacob Rees-Mogg has been referred to as Lord Snooty a lot, and I found some memes with, kind of a mishmash between Rees-Mogg and Snooty. And I think that is unfair on Lord Snooty.
Yes.
But prior to that, funny enough, I'd forgotten about this until I had a look on an article on the internet, was that Private Eye had done Dave Snooty and His Pals, which was a parody of David Cameron, obviously, in the late 2000s. And it was a little, because at the same time, actually, Private Eye was doing The Bruins, which was about Gordon Brown. So they were doing both. So Watkins was getting doubly honoured, in a way. There was The Bruins, but there was Dave Snooty and His Pals, and The Pals being his fellow Etonians. And you can see Cameron actually dressed up like Lord Snooty. So it's actually really quite, in a way, it's effective, but as you've just mentioned, it's not actually representative of who Lord Snooty actually was. He was actually the opposite of what, yes, David Cameron was.
Yes, because as we said, he is more downwardly mobile in a way. Yes. The sort of out-of-touch, posh, upper-class person that the name has come to symbolise, that's not what the comic character was really at all.
Not at all, not at all.
I'll also mention that the Lord Snooty has been name-checked in songs by the Bonzo Dog Doodah Band. Always interesting when a comic character sort of crosses into the zeitgeist, but here it's done in a sort of strange way.
And I think it's probably that longevity of the character that has enabled. Yeah, he's obviously very fondly remembered, and perhaps by those readers who were reading it in the 40s, 50s, and then it got into the mainstream. Because by the time the 70s and the 80s, I don't think the stories are terribly good. Interestingly, he was rebooted. That's the other thing, as you maybe in the 2000s, but I've never read the reboot, but apparently the character is much more unsympathetic. She's probably more in line with somebody who actually has a lot of money and likes to revel in the money. I think that was kind of the angle they took, and it wasn't popular with the readership. That's interesting when you compare what they realized in those early days of the Beano. We need to make sure that our readers can relate to this character in some way, even though he's maybe not very much like the readership. We need to make sure there's a link in some way to make him attractive in that respect and relatable.
So I've got this single volume of Lord Snooty, 60 Years of Classic Cartoon Art. You've got some other books and bits and pieces about Dudley Watkins and his characters. Were there any other of your reference materials you wanted to mention here, Robert?
I think that the main one would be the Beano and Dandy, A Celebration of Dudley D. Watkins, came out in, as I say, in 2000. It's 2020. Apologies. It's a really interesting volume, and it covers kind of a little bit of all his characters. So you get a good bit of Snooty, you get a good bit of Desperate Dan. You also get things like, which we haven't touched on, Jimmy and His Magic Patch, which was a more, again, this was in the Beano, but you can actually see from the style of artwork that it's a more boys comic-y kind of style of artwork. So this is, I guess it's more of a traditional storytelling from those times where you have the picture on top and then you have the narration underneath, or the text is
right. Oh yes, yeah.
The actual illustration. You also have some of his. I mentioned the fact that he did work for evangelical organizations, and actually towards the end here, you have, for example, he was actually. I read that one of his ambitions was to try to do almost like a graphic novel of the Bible, and you can see there's the story of David, and again, that's a more conservative kind of artwork that you can see that's done there, for example. But there's all sorts in here. There's Dave, there's Mickey, there's Biffo the Bear, there's Ginger, So all the sorts of characters that he's very well known of, as well as those maybe more unusual ones. This is where I showed you the Persevere cartoons in, another one called Wandering Willie, who again was a very early creation of his. So you've got quite a few, you get the whole gamut of Watkins' work. So it's well worth having a look out for that, I would say, if you're interested in Watkins.
Excellent stuff. Well, I've just been looking now, as we've said, this very large format hardback that you and I have both got, The Legend of Lord Snooty and His Pals, is out of print, but it's very cheap on the secondhand markets. I think we both, well, yours was a present, but mine was, it's got a sticker on the back from Age UK for 99p. So, and I've just looked, while you were talking, I was looking on Amazon for the Beano and Dandy Dudley Watkins book you've just been talking about, which I can see for £2.
Oh, wow. So pick it up.
Yeah, pick it up. Exactly. So that is that's certainly where to look for these books. And also perhaps to get some R. Willie and the Bruins books as well. And if anybody wants to pick it for the podcast.
I think it would be, I'm sure you've covered John Wagner many times, so you know, there would be no harm doing Watkins again. And actually, a deep dive into R. Woolley and the Bruins would be extremely interesting, I think, to do. But it's interesting just in terms of picking these books up very cheaply. We know a lot of comics seem to rise in price, and it's quite odd in some ways that the T.C. Thompson work maybe just isn't as respected or as valued as maybe as much as it possibly should be or could be. It's a bit of a shame in some respect. I mean, it's good that you can pick it up really cheap, but it's a shame in a way as well.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we'd all like some of this British comics heritage to be a bit more appreciated than it appears to be. Let's talk about the value of possibly the original art. I did find a few Dudley Watkins pages on the Comic Art Fans website, but I didn't find any Lord Snooty there. If we look at the artwork in this volume and in the other books you've got, did you have a page or two for the Grail Page game that you would pick out for us, Robert?
Yeah. I mean, if I could have anything, I think I would probably love Watkins to draw me R. Woolley on his bucket.
Right.
That's the absolute zenith, if you like, of what I would like from Dudley D. Watkins. And there are a few pages of it like that. But in terms of this Lord Snooty book, let me see if I can find the right page. And I should have marked this up beforehand. But it's a story that you alluded to earlier. If I can find it.
Is it page 40?
Yes. So this is the January 3rd, 1942. I might be stealing your thunder, Eamon. I'm not sure. But this had to be the choice from this book for me, although some of the other war stories are so good, I could have gone for some of them. But this is the story where Lord Snooty meets Dudley D. Watkins. It's a fantastic. And what's great about it is that there's no reverence in the strip. In fact, first of all, Snooty meets him, and then he complains to him about the way he's being depicted in the comics. I don't look good. And Watkins has enough of him, and he actually boots him out of the house, literally boots him out of the house, which is great. What then happens is that some rivals of the Ashcan Alley gang turn up the gasworks gang, and Watkins says, "Oh, I'll draw you." So he starts drawing them, and when his back is turned, Snooty actually replaces the artwork that Watkins has done with some that he's illustrated, which is more insulting towards the gasworks gang. So what then happens at the end is the gasworks gang sees this illustration, then they beat up Watkins. So you end up with Watkins in a pile at the end, with a black eye, jeans or trousers torn, all the rest of it. So there's no reverence. It's all done absolutely for humour, and it works really effectively. And again, this is, to my mind, it's coming towards the end of the golden age of Lord Snooty cartoons, but it's this one goes with a bang for sure.
So that is, as you say, January the 3rd, 1942, the Beano, page 40 in this book. We're quite fortunate in this book that we have both page numbers and dates on
yes.
them, which is
yes.
nice. Well done, D.C. Thompson, for that. and yes, you've got a depiction of Dudley D. Watkins. And as you say, it's just a great comic adventure, plus the fact that they Lord Snooty doesn't like him.
That's right. That's great.
Yeah. You wanted to mention a page from another one of the books that you yes. talked about.
Yes, if you don't mind. So this is from the celebration of Dudley D. Watkins, and I'm showing you a cover of the Beano. Cover date is October the 25th, 1969. It's Biffo the Bear. Now, the story here, if you were to read it, is, again, it's not terribly good. It's not terribly exciting. But the reason I wanted to pick this one is because this is, if as far as I know, this was the last published work in the Beano, certainly.
Right.
So much so that it was only half completed. David Sutherland, who's the other... another D.C. Thompson legend who was on the Bash Street Kids for decades, he actually finished the strip off. So it's an amalgamation. It's not just Watkins. It's an amalgamation of Watkins and David Sutherland. And I must confess, I did wonder, was this what he was working on whenever he keeled over at drawing board? So it's a very poignant... It's not, as I say, the strip itself is pretty banal. It's not great, but... it's because of its poignancy, and I guess if that page came up on those websites, that one probably would go for a few bob, I would say.
Yeah,
because of it's
one of his last strip, pages.
You know.
Yeah,
it's also it's a co-production with another Beano legend as well. So that's the other Grail page that I would go for.
Excellent. Well, as ever, I will post these pages on the socials when this episode comes out. I was very tempted by the appearance of Dudley D. Watkins himself in the strip. But as you've picked that, I will pick another wartime strip. And I think I probably will have page 54, July 17th, 1943, just because it touches on that slap-up feast idea that happens again and again in comics of this period that I find so interesting. That was the one I referred to earlier on, where with the assistance of Professor Screwtop, Lord Snooty and his pals arranged to feed the troops with soup, roast beef, potatoes, cabbage and ginger beer.
That's great.
So great stuff. And I'll post these on the socials the week after this episode comes out so people can see what we've been talking about and help celebrate the work, the life and work of Dudley Watkins. Great stuff, Robert. Anything else from your notes or the other books of reference that you had about Watkins and the Beano?
Not really. Just to say, as we've mentioned, this is a comic book legend. There's some terrific material throughout. We didn't touch on, and I'm very reluctant to maybe mention this, but some of his strips probably wouldn't get republished today. There are stereotyping issues. Maybe we'll leave it at that. But the stuff that that is available and publishable today it's very good, very interesting. He's a comics legend for sure in terms of what he has done over the decades, and such a variety of work as well, and so much good stuff. And as you mentioned, if it's quite easy to pick up things like R. Woolley and the Bruins quite straightforwardly, and they're if you've never read those are really quite interesting. I should have mentioned actually one contrast between R. Woolley and the Bruins and the stuff in the Beano is that R. Woolley and the Bruins is very social realist in some respects. You know, it's very grounded. Everything is real, whereas the stuff, as we've mentioned, from Lord Snooty is very surreal. But the it works very well, the R. Woolley and the Bruins stuff, especially maybe the stuff from the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s when Watkins was drawing, very reflective of what Scottish working class life was like at the time. So very interesting. These things are always very interesting in terms of social history, I think.
Right. Yeah, I mean, yes, they are indeed. And as we've said, this is a very cheap book, and the Dudley D. Watkins book for £2 on Amazon, I'm probably going to pick that up as well.
Yeah. Recommended.
Recommended. Great stuff, Robert. Lord Snooty and His Pals, The Legend of 60 Years of Classic Cartoon Art by Dudley D. Watkins. Other stuff to talk about and guest projects. Now, last time you'd published an article with some quite interesting stuff looking at Anne Nesenti's run on Daredevil, I believe.
That's right.
What have you been writing about and working on recently?
So more recently, I published an article in the Journal of Graphic Novels and Comics called, I think if I remember correctly, Slippers, Canes and Hospitalizations, Adult to Child Violence in 1970s British Comics, or something like that anyway. And it's really about the way which things like slippering, which we're all familiar with from the Beano, the Dandy and the IPC comics as well, how that was prevalent in the 1970s and how that was kind of phased out. And I sort of compare it with the way that we have changed our understanding of child protection and safeguarding and things like that over the decades. And the Beano actually maybe being slightly ahead of the curve in terms of the way it took out the use of the slipper in the 1980s prior to really... There's still a very much in the public imagination the idea that this was okay and this was fine into the early 2000s for sure. So yeah, that's what that article is about. So if anyone wants to read that, that'd be great.
Well, I will put a link to that in the show notes for this episode. And again, it's another bit of British comic history which represents. A different era in a way, isn't it? Yes. As you say, this is the idea that a slipper nowadays is anything other than a comfy indoor shoe is quite remarkable, because back in the 70s, as you say, when the father figure in the comic reached for their slipper, you knew that basically corporal punishment was coming. Fascinating. I will put a link to that. And you also mentioned somebody else's articles about Lord Snooty, which I'll put in the show notes as well. A link to that as well. Canes and slippers. Oh dear.
We're better without them.
Yes, indeed. Indeed. One of my teachers used a ping pong bat, a table tennis bat, which had a face drawer on it for some reason. But anyway, there you go. remarkable that's thank goodness that sort of thing has, as you say, died out of popular culture. I'm interested in bits of the popular culture that have seemed to have... disappearing into history, things from our childhoods that are now disappearing, anyway, great stuff, Robert. Thank you so much for coming back on to do Lord Snooty, an interesting choice, and allowed us to talk about the genius of Dudley D. Watkins. So great stuff.
Thank you, really appreciate it.
And thank you to everyone for listening to Mega City Book Club. As ever, follow us on all the socials, the nice ones, where you'll find us posting pictures from Dudley D. Watkins when this episode comes out. Find all the links, including links to Robert's projects, on megacitybookclub.com. And if you're the person to do Willie and the Bruins with me, then email me mcbcpodcast@gmail.com. And that'll do us for this time. Until next time, when we're passing judgment on another great book, it's goodbye from me, and
it's goodbye from me. Wow.